Hello, this is David Wilk for Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm here today with David Morrell, who's the author of a new book about to come out, actually in July, called The Shimmer. Hi, David. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, thank you. I live in New Mexico in Santa Fe, and it's a beautiful day here, 70 degrees, and I can see for hundreds of miles outside my window.
Do you live up in the hills outside of town?
Yes. A lot of people think Santa Fe is like Scottsdale or Phoenix or something like that, but actually we're closer to what might be a Vail or Aspen, and we're in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains at about 7,300 feet, and it's a ski area. You can see the snow on the mountains to the north, and if I wanted to ski, I could go up and probably get there in 20 minutes. So it's but basically we're in a mountain valley, and right across the valley is at night you can see the glow of Los Alamos, where they invented the atomic bomb.
How long have you lived in Santa Fe?
Oh, since 1992. There was actually, people ask me why I used to be a professor at the University of Iowa. American literature was my specialty, and I taught while I was writing, although I did resign in 1986. But in 92, we decided to move elsewhere, and we fell in love with New Mexico through, of all things, a television show called This Old House, which was doing a renovation on a property in New Mexico in Santa Fe. And the architecture here is so unusual, if you feel like you're in old Mexico, it's almost like feeling being in another country. And when we saw that there were mountains and what have you, we just really felt compelled to come here and live.
Well, I think it probably a feeling shared by a number of people. Santa Fe is an area which has attracted writers and artists for many, many years, I think.
Well, they call it the land of enchantment for the whole state, and the city has the it's somewhat funny. They call it the city different, and it is indeed different. It's kind of a screwy. You sometimes think you're in a separate time warp. A number of years ago, just a small example, a number of years ago, there was a man who was the in charge of the post office, and mail wasn't being delivered, and they finally, after he left, they found this room in the basement of the post office with like 100,000 pieces of mail that never got delivered.
That's a terrifying image, I think. Well, so
yeah.
are you're originally from Canada, though, is that right?
Yes.
So
yes, I was raised in southern Ontario near Toronto, and I moved to the United States when I was in my early 20s to get a doctorate at Penn State.
And are you now an American citizen, or are you still Canadian?
I am. It isn't easy. Sometimes what you see in the newspaper, people saying, well, why don't these aliens become citizens? I got to tell you, it is not easy. It takes a tremendous amount of time going back and forth to embassies or comparable places of government, and there's a complicated exam. There are 200 questions, 10 of which the examiner can ask you about the United States government. And I tell you, when I dug in to study for it, and I taught American literature, and I thought I knew this stuff, you'd be surprised what I had to learn. And we would have done it sooner when we were living in Iowa, but it was a 5-hour drive to Omaha, where the government was, and then back and forth. I think we would have had to make 3 trips, and there was some other things. And finally, when we got to New Mexico, we hired an immigration attorney, and he was able to get through all the red tape in order to make it happen. But yes, my wife and I are now American citizens.
I tend to think mostly that immigrants end up knowing more about the United States than people who are born and raised here, and that's sounds like it
well,
may be true.
I'll tell you, some of those questions, and just the general versatility with the language, you have to be able to, they dictate a paragraph to you, a complex language, and you have to be able to write it down without spelling mistakes, etc. And I could do it, but there are some people, I dare say, who've lived here all their lives who would not be able to pass the exam, that they would not qualify for citizenship.
Right. It's sort of like what they say about us who are older. When our kids go to college, they usually tell us, you would probably never have been able to get into this school when you were a kid, because it's so much more difficult now. So, well, let's talk a little bit. I wanted to talk a little bit about your life as a writer.
Yeah.
It's sort of interesting that you were a professor. People usually think of professors as not being creative writers. It's kind of, you know, I know that's not a fair image, but I think it's probably fair to say. How did you go from being someone who studied literature to actually writing it?
Well, I had a dream that started when I was 17 years old, and many people listening to this won't know the series that I'm talking about, but in 1960, a television series called Route 66 premiered on CBS, and I love to give the specifics, you know, 8:30 at night on the East Coast on Friday, first Friday of October, and it changed my life. I absolutely fell in love with the series about two young men traveling across the United States in a Corvette convertible. And the promos used to say, "In search of America and in search of themselves." And it was filmed entirely on location, wherever, in theory, these young men drove to get work and what have you. And it was a tremendous amount of action in it, coupled with an amazing amount of philosophic speeches. It was sort of like Jack Kerouac. And I absolutely fell in love. And I noticed after a time that the scripts were primarily being written by a man with an unusual name, Sterling Siliphant. It was easy to notice that name. And I began corresponding with Sterling and basically told him that I wanted to do what he did, and in fact, I wanted to be what he was. And he sent me encouraging letters back, and I was in high school at the time and had no interest in finishing my education, but it seemed clear to me that given the level of intelligence that was in these Route 66 scripts coupled with the action, that I needed to get an education. So I finished high school, I got a BA, and then I decided to get a master's degree and a PhD, and that's how I wound up going to the United States to Penn State, and you know, always the goal was to be Sterling Siliphant. And many years later, Sterling and I met, and in fact, it was Sterling who arranged, who took The Brotherhood of the Rose, my novel, The Brotherhood of the Rose, to NBC and told them that they ought to do an action miniseries, and they in fact filmed it, and it premiered after the Super Bowl. I love to be able to say that. Premiered after the Super Bowl in 1989. With Robert Mitchum in it, and the big thing for me was that Sterling was the executive producer on that show, so that I got to work with him after having been inspired by him so many years earlier. So there was never any doubt in my mind from the age of 17 that I was going to be a professional writer. It was a question how to do it, and you know, it's hard to earn a living being a writer. I've been fortunate, but not every writer is, and so I knew I needed a day job, and I figured teaching, I love teaching, and being with young, bright people and being with books, that you couldn't ask for a better day job for somebody who wanted to write. And when I taught at Iowa, what I would do is, you know, I would teach, and in my off hours when I wasn't doing prep or else meeting with students, I would write. And then I'd get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and I'd write, and I'd write on the weekends. And I did that for 16 years and finally got so tired that I finally said I can't do both, and I resigned my professorship. But the goal was to be a writer, and then the professor thing came as a, you know, as a kind of consequence to that. But I'll tell you something that occurred to me years later. I remembered that I had met the great jazz pianist Oscar Peterson in Toronto once at a club, and I asked him. It occurred to me that Oscar was a jazz pianist who had been classically trained. He started as a concert pianist. And I said, "Gee, you know," I asked him basically, "which do you prefer?" And he said, "both." Well, you know, what was he going to say? But I thought later that in a certain way, without comparing Oscar's huge talent to whatever I can do, that in a way I became Oscar Peterson as well, because I was classically trained as a writer. I have all this education about books and the history of the novel, and so I know my way around books and inside the structure of books in a way that many novelists who are intuitive more than analytic do not. So I think in some ways that pairing of the classical training with the kind of jazz, if you like, thing that involves writing novels, that might be one thing that characterizes what I do.
Well, it also seems to help explain one of the features of your novels that's fairly interesting, and that is that every one of them that I've read has an underpinning of serious research into some skill set. I mean, I remember Creepers that had the archaeologist, the urban archaeologist in it.
Yes.
And had a lot of architecture-related stuff. Now here, the new book, which is coming out in July, called The Shimmer, it relates to a pretty interesting set of natural phenomena or unknown phenomena in a place called Marfa, Texas.
Yes, Marfa, Texas is fascinating. I have a habit, people say, where do your ideas come from? And I, they're everywhere. You just have to be receptive. And I think one difference between a professional writer and somebody who sort of would like one day to be a writer is that the professional writer always has the antenna ready to receive. And one morning here in Santa Fe, I was reading the newspaper, and I read about this town in Texas, Marfa, Texas. It's a small town in West Texas, where lights appear every night. The more I read about these lights, the more fascinated I became that, the lights had been there. They've been witnessed as way, way back. In 1889, there was a rancher on a cattle drive who saw these lights and thought they were Native Americans, or what they would have called Indians in those days, and maybe they were marauders and what have you. So they were all very nervous. And in the morning, they went looking for these campfires that they thought the Indians had, and they couldn't find anything. And over the years, the lights had been observed again and again and again. In the First World War, they were observed, and people thought they were Germans sneaking across the Mexican border. And on and on and on. Some people might recognize Marfa because it's the location for the great James Dean film Giant. And Dean, when he was filming there, saw the lights and became obsessed with them and used to go every night and look at the lights. And he tried to get Rock Hudson and Elizabeth Taylor and other people to come out and see the lights, but they just didn't get they didn't see what he was seeing. And you can go on and on and on. In about 1980, there was a ghost light hunt where several hundred people went all over that pasture area where the lights appeared and couldn't find anything. They looked for them in the horseback and jeep and airplanes and everything. And I just went crazy about this idea and did a lot of research. And finally, I just couldn't resist writing about it when a fan of mine, a reader from Australia, where a version of these lights appear, and I had asked him if he knew anything about the lights that sort of corresponded with Marfa. In Australia, they're called the Min Min lights, and he said no about them. They stalked me once. He and his father had been out hunting at night, and by God, a light started to follow him, follow them, and he has a very interesting story about how frightening it was. And I said, all right, that's it. I gotta write this book. So what I've done is it's a book about how people become obsessed with a phenomenon like these lights. And at the same time, it's a book that encapsulates in a kind of fictionalized way all the real stuff that's involved with the Marfa lights. That rancher, for example, is in the book, and James Dean, under another name, is in the book, and the Marfa ghost light hunt is in the book. I call my town Rostov. Marfa was named after a character in a Russian novel, so I picked Tolstoy's War and Peace. It's that professor thing. I picked Tolstoy's War and Peace, where there's a Count Rostov, and I thought that's a good name for a town. And it was fun to kind of create an alternative version of Marfa, Texas, with all the historical events that involved the lights, And at the same time, you know, to make it very, very clear that it was David Morrell's version of the lights.
Well, it's, and you, of course, you have a riveting story. I have to say that, you know, when I first picked it up, you know, I read a lot of books. I don't finish every book that I pick up to read. I wasn't intending to read your book. I had something else that I was actually working on at the time. And I have to compliment you. I think what really struck me was you were able to get me from the beginning. You know, you captured my attention, which of course is, you know, the true test, I think, of most great novels is in the first few pages, you either get somebody involved or you don't. And you did. So I raced through the novel, which has just a riveting story. And I was aside from the lights, which are fascinating and kind of intriguing to anybody interested in unusual phenomena, you have also got some pretty strong characters, and a pretty complicated storyline, a relationship between a guy and his wife. And, we won't give away the story, but, there's a lot of mayhem as well, which, is kind of riveting and scary at the same time.
Well, you know, it's a big book. It's not a long book, but it's a big book in the sense that while it's set now, it encapsulates, 130 years of West Texas history. Some really fascinating, again, that story about that rancher thinking he was going to be attacked and trying to find the source of the lights the next morning. I knew it needed a big cast of characters. A lot to do with, some of your listeners might know a Billy Wilder movie called The Big Carnival, sometimes known as Ace in the Hole. And Kirk Douglas plays a reporter who kind of takes advantage of a mine accident in New Mexico. And it's about the media. And I thought, if we have these lights, and let's say one night somebody shows up and starts shooting at them, and then turns around and starts shooting at the people watching the lights, that would be a big story. And so I thought I would like to get a television reporter and go through how he approaches reporting the story and how the lights change him. And he is one of, there's a highway patrol officer in the book. There's a leader of a secret military group that's in the book. But the main character, is this Santa Fe police officer whose wife disappears on her way to visit her mother in Texas, and the wife basically has become obsessed by the lights. And so the story is principally about this really fascinating police officer and how he's trying to save his marriage, essentially, it's a love story in a way, as much as it's an action story. It's about what it means to be married and what he does in order to try to basically save his wife from this obsession that she has. So it's a big story. It's got a lot of emotional content in it, and it's about something. It's about, there are flying sequences in it, and at one point, the police officer who has seen an awful lot of terrible things in his career, and he's a pilot. He flies a Cessna 172, and he's a pilot primarily because when you fly a plane, you can't think about anything else. And so on his days off, he flies to get above it all, as he calls it. And this concept of getting above it all and how you distract yourself from the horror in the world is a big part of the theme of the book.
Yeah, and I thought, very, scenes with the mass murderer, again, I don't want to give away too much of the story, but the mass murder takes place and there's a kind of terrible event that attracts the media, has kind of, unfortunately, tremendous resonance for a lot of events that have been going on lately.
We see it a lot on television. And what I wanted to do, I went to, research is such a big deal for me, and I have a friend who's a novelist who is a reporter for a television station in Boston, and she was very, very kind to teach me a lot about. Her name is Hank Philippi Ryan. Her books are absolutely fascinating about a television reporter in Boston. It's sort of like her, only she fictionalizes it. And so she gave me a lot of tips about how in real life all of this is handled, especially about the equipment. I really enjoy learning details about how things are done. You know, how heavy is a battery that you put in a camera, in a video camera, for example, and how long does the battery last, and things of that nature. And in a comparable way, thinking about research, because I do so much research for my books. I mentioned this character who's a private pilot, and I thought, I knew there were going to be at least four flying sequences in the book, and one of which where they try to find the lights by chasing them, and that doesn't turn out too well. And I knew immediately that I couldn't just go talk to a pilot. I just wouldn't feel confident. So as I started the book, I also started pilot training, and I've been going for quite a while now, and hope that I was up for a couple hours yesterday, in fact, and hope to have my pilot's license by the time the book comes out, by the time The Shimmer is published in July. And, it's one of the great things about writing is that you get to learn so much, that you pick a subject that fascinates and then dive into it. And with luck, when I finish a book, I'm a fuller person than when I started it because of all the things that I've learned and how those things have changed me.
Well, and that I think that we would hope then that contributes, or I think it does contribute to the transformation of the reader as well. I'd like to really recommend to readers this book called The Shimmer by David Morrell. And thank you, David, so much for spending some time today talking to me. I hope to see you one of these days when you're flying around doing your next book tour.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Take care.